We are at Vanderbilt's psychology department in Wilson Hall with Jonathan Falstein, who's been working on some categorization experiments and is going to explain them to us with the aid of your trusty Mac. So first of all, give me some sense of what the task was, what the overall view aim of the experiment was, and why you're doing it.
Well, we're studying the effect of category learning on visual perception and also on object representations in the visual system. And our hypothesis is that when you learn a category, you have to attend to some features, but not others. And that will have consequences, possibly for stable changes in visual perception as a result of category learning.
Now, in the conversation I had earlier with René Marois, he was making the point about the attentional bottleneck and so on, that a naive view is that brains are just these amazing computers that can handle all this information, do all sorts of things. But what you're saying is that when you actually get into the lab and put people in front of experiments, you very quickly discover that there are attentional bottlenecks and that there are attention and focuses on different stimuli and so on.
That's true. You attend to some features and not others. And that has, what we generally find is that visual representations of the features that you attend become more distinguished, more elaborated, whereas visual representations of the things that you ignore tend to stay the same.
Okay. So you bring people in here and you present them with a series of, well, you tell me, how do you go about this enterprise?
Well, we show them a series of very similar cars, one at a time, and we teach them to categorize the cars. The cars are shown here. This shows all the car stimuli together. And so, for instance, in one example, a participant might learn that all of these cars were in one category, whereas all of these cars were in a different category. And as you can see, the cars are rather difficult to tell mm-hmm. apart. They're constructed by blending various combinations of these four cars along these axes. And so
these are all computer generated? And
yes, they're morphed using computer software.
And they range from this slightly more chubby one down here up to the slightly sleeker one up there, right?
Well, these are orthogonal
right.
Dimensions, so they range from this one to this one and from this one to this one. And each car is a blend of positions along these two morph lines.
Okay.
And so both before and after they're trained to categorize these cars, we test the ability to visually distinguish between visually discriminate between pairs of very similar cars that differ in, for instance, this direction in the space. So these two cars, if you were trained on this versus this, would differ on features that were relevant for category learning, whereas these two cars differ on features that could be ignored during category learning.
Now, just unpack that a little bit more, since that's not everyday language. What do you mean that you would go horizontally to find differences in category learning, whereas it doesn't mm-hmm. apply vertically?
Well, we're not sure what the features are, because these are very complex morphed stimuli. But in order to learn that these cars, ways that these cars differ from these cars, in order to categorize them, you have to pay attention to features that differ between this parent and this parent. Whereas features that differ between this parent can be ignored because all of these cars are in the same category and all of these cars are in the same category. So in order to categorize them correctly, you have to pay attention to certain features but not others. So these two cars will differ on features that differ somewhat between along this morph line.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas these two cars will differ according to features that differ along this more irrelevant morph line. And so what we find is that before category learning, these and these all have the same visual discriminability. But after category learning, these that differ in relevant features to category learning become more easy to discriminate, to tell apart visually.
So you train people and they get better?
They get better at, they get better at categorization, but they also get better at visual discrimination, which they weren't explicitly trained on.
All right, now, so there's obviously more of a take home than that, because that simply sounds like, okay, you show people, you train them on visual stimuli and different categories, and over time they get better. Is that?
Well, it means that...
The question is, where are they getting better and how?
Right. So the way that you categorize the world affects the way you visually perceive the world, rather than simply the way that you think about the world or group the cars together conceptually. This has consequences for visual perception. And we've shown this in an fMRI study in which we, again, train participants to categorize the cars. And then we compare neural adaptation to cars that differ in, again, on relevant features versus irrelevant features. And we find that cars that differ in relevant features, in particular cars that are in different categories, adapt less in the visual system, in the ventral stream of the visual system, than cars that differ in features that are irrelevant for the category learning, suggesting again that learning is specific to the visual system and category learning has consequences for visual perception.
Now, if you had to explain the relevance of this, you know, you're just walking down the street with some friends from another department who don't do what you do, and you wanted to extend it beyond the fact that here you're using cars as the object. I mean, this is not about getting to be a better car spotter, is it?
No, it's about we have to categorize the world every day into in all sorts of different ways, different psychologists have different views about where that happens in the brain and how you do that. Some would say that categorization only has consequences for, say, concepts and representations in prefrontal cortex. But we've shown that it penetrates all the way down into at least into V4, into somewhat simple levels of the visual system. Mm-hmm. And that has consequences for how we see, how we think about all sorts of objects.
So I'm going to press you on this, because I know this is not what you're here for. The idea is to get the experiment, get some work together, and put it into a larger body of work that all has implications and so on. But just let me press you on where this one might be going. I mean, in terms of people's everyday experience, what can you tell them about, maybe in a classroom, for example, is there some way in which this is relevant to how teachers are presenting information, if they knew more about what's going on at this level?
Well, this could give us ways of testing how effective teaching techniques are in terms of changes to the visual system. We might, if the students are learning to categorize objects effectively, that might have consequences that we could test in a visual discrimination experiment. Mm-hmm. In later experiments, we'll start looking at the temporal dynamics of these changes. And so we'll see, for instance, whether you need to relearn to categorize the stimuli at particular intervals in order to maximize the visual consequences, learning consequences, or it might be possible that these effects appear rather quickly and stick around for a fairly long time.
Okay, so there's a connection there with the work that Hal Pashler has been doing, of course, where he's been looking at interval spacing in terms of effectively when should you revise your work if you're taking an exam. I mean, that's one application of it, at least. How soon or how later should you be given a second installment or revise that work and so on.
Yes,
so
this gives us a way to look at spacing and effective spacing for consequence for learning categories, and again, there are consequences for this particular realm of vision.
Yeah, but so what kind of information could you be realistically learning in a classroom that this car work translates to? Can you imagine that? I mean,
well, it could be something like birding, perhaps, or it could be learning the shape of molecules in chemistry. Uh-huh. Lots of molecules in chemistry have very similar shapes and features, and for different kinds of distinctions, we might learn to visually notice different subtle differences between molecules very quickly, maybe. I think that's part of it. You might be able to learn to recognize certain classes of objects very quickly and automatically, rather than having to count different kinds of features. So that's one possibility, I think. Animals, any kind of animals, evolution, biology, cells, bacteria all look very similar, and you might, in learning to distinguish very similar kinds of bacteria, again, you become an expert and learn to perceive important differences very quickly and automatically.
So this is all connected as well with the whole notion of perceptual improvement in perceptual skills. The work that we've been talking with Isabel about as well, in terms of the greebles and so on and so forth. It's all part of the same.
Yes. And so different kinds of enterprise. Different kinds of learning might have different consequences. So face-like expertise might come from individuation of very specific kinds of things, but this kind of learning might come when, they might be related, but this kind of learning might come when there's a particular set of features that you can attend to while ignoring others. And both of those kinds of things might have relevance in different areas. We don't really know.
Yeah, I just think that this whole notion of perceptual expertise is something that folks at home don't normally think about. The idea of even the phrase like perceptual fluency, I mean, you usually think of verbal fluency. How fast am I talking? How many words are you using? Are they big words? Are they small words? And so on. So the idea of whether you can be fluent or more fluent in your perceptual skills is I think, something most people don't think about.
It's a skill that people can learn, that's
true.
Yeah,
but I think they think that you're almost talking about what artists do or something like that, which is not the case.
That's true,
We were talking to Yetta Wong earlier about the music stuff as well. So that's a parallel case?
Yes, and learning to make associations between music, visual notes and sounds, and the feel of an instrument has consequences for the visual system and consequences all over the brain.
Yeah. So I tend to ask this as people starting their careers and so on. How did you settle on this as a way of earning a crust?
Well, I've always been really fascinated by knowledge and how people represent knowledge of the world around them. And I started out as a philosophy major studying epistemology. Then I decided to go into cognitive science because it seemed a much more effective way of answering those kinds of questions of what form our knowledge takes, how we know when we know something, and visual representation of objects is one part of that.
Okay, so when you started doing philosophy and so on, I mean, the transition between there and how to unpack some philosophical concepts and impart them with pragmatic experimental data. Did you find that an interesting transition or an easy transition?
I found it quite natural. I mean, you get...
Did you have a philosophical position when you came into this? Let me ask you.
Sure.
Did you have a model of what the mind is and what human nature consists of before you came into this and started being forced to actually test that scientifically?
I guess I came into it kind of pretty influenced by Wittgenstein and the idea that objects all around had family resemblances, and you represent things in terms of overall similarity between an object that you were trying to look at. And it was sort of this fuzzy kind of process where you just sort of see it and you put it into a family according to global similarity. And that's true, but I came to learn that rules are important as well. And so you can, selective attention is very important, and that is a more Platonic idea, that you can selectively attend to important diagnostic features. And all of these things are related, they're all true, mm-hmm. and we're just trying to figure out how they all those processes work together.
So do you keep up with the philosophy? Still interested?
I'm not so much. I go to the philosophy lectures every once in a while, but for the most part, there's plenty to think about here, and it's addressing these questions in a, I don't know, I, you know, philosophy's great, but in a much more precise way, I think, than just talking about it or reasoning about what could be true.
Yeah. So, speculating a little bit, I know, but where would you see this stage you're at? What trajectory you think might emerge from that for you over time?
In terms of the research, do you mean?
Research, career, what do you want to do with it?
Well, I think I'm moving towards trying to write my own R01, and I think that this research gives a really good foundation for doing that. We've got a lot of questions to ask and answer in the future, a lot of follow-up to do based on the temporal dynamics of the effect of category learning on vision, and I think there's a lot to do there. We can look at different kinds of features, for instance, motion versus shape, as opposed to these subtle distinctions in shape. And we can look at more abstract kinds of features that have many different instantiations.
Yeah. I don't want to shoehorn what you're doing into some preconceived notion of mine, but let me just try something on you, which is that most of the major media stories that I've read in the last 3 months, and these have been cover stories of Newsweek or the New York Times Magazine, an issue of The Atlantic, they've all been stories about teaching, how to build better teachers, let's fire all the bad teachers, how do you make a good teacher, and so on and so forth. And that's all important. But I think one of the things that I'm missing is how do you build a better learner? How do you create a research framework in which the information aids teachers and students themselves for the students to become better learners? And do you think that this kind of work has an application in that kind of arena?
Well, I think it does on down the line, sure. I think that we can
As I said, I'm not trying to force you into saying.
Yeah. Well, we can. This gives us a way of accessing what kids have learned in a different way. So a lot of the time, you might test them on verbal knowledge that they've learned about some category, but we can also test them on visual knowledge that they have that may not have been directly taught. Mm-hmm. We can use this as a way of looking at how effective different kinds of techniques are in terms of just penetrating past perhaps memorized facts and more into skills that have become internalized. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, perceptual fluency, and this can go into motor learning as well. I mean, you can, some activities require sort of fast and automatic motor skills, mm-hmm. and one might test that knowledge, again, just using memorized facts, or one might test it using more motor-driven tasks that are more automatic and may not necessarily have been directly learned.
So. And you also mentioned, and of course, the whole notion of examining reinforcement schedules for visually presented information as opposed to simply verbal fluency as well.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, how effective is visual learning? How can we best effectively make perceptual changes that stick, or perceptual improvements that stick?
Now this work gets published, is in press, right? The Nature Neuroscience, is it?
We're still working on it. It'll be submitted soon.
Okay,
it's very new, yes.
All right, well, good luck with that and the future research.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you too. Thanks. Thank you.